I'm Lisa DeLay, and you're listening to the Spark My Muse podcast.
Nice to meet you, Lisa.
You too. It's such a pleasure to talk to you, and I know you're a busy man, so the fact that you could meet with me at all, I was like over the moon and very excited.
Oh no, delighted. You met with a friend of mine who recommended you, David Dark.
Yeah.
Yeah. So when you wrote, I did a bit of research on you. And then saw that you met with David Dark. So
yeah, and also Peter Rollins too.
Oh right, oh yes.
So he was the one. Well, originally I had been exposed to your work through the Krista Tippett episode that you did with her, and then I was enchanted with your work and what you do, and then you were brought up in my mind again when I listened to your song Maranatha through the things that Peter Rollins was exposing us to in Atheism for Lent. And I broke down into tears, and it was just at the right moment to break.
Or the
me
wrong
right
moment.
It was a good. It was a you catastrophe,
Was this? That's a nice. Line from Tolkien.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. And I've been really enjoying how you use language and bring out these richer meanings in words, and I thought would be so lovely to talk with you more and to read your work more. And so I dug into In the Shelter, and then when you said you could come on, I was really surprised, because I know it's not like you're just, you know, twiddling your thumbs wondering what to do next.
No, unfortunately not. That would be quite nice. Sorry, I'm just moving your chair here. Yes. I'm working from home today, actually, and I realize how much I miss that, because at times when I've done writing more full time, I just work from an office at home. And I love that. But life is busy these days.
Normally, I wind up introducing everybody on the show in some sort of introduction. But I think what I'll wind up doing is putting that in later and just maybe asking you if you would introduce yourself, how you describe yourself and the work that you do on a daily basis.
Yeah, so my name is Padraig O'Tooma. I'm from Cork and I live in Belfast in the north of Ireland. I am the leader of the Coromila community, which is Ireland's oldest peace and reconciliation community. Since 1965, Coromila has been responding to sectarian divisions and other divisions that occur in the north of Ireland and beyond, and responding to that with hospitality and friendship and faith and dialogue. So I've been in my role for the last 2.5 years. I was poet in residence for about 8 years previous to that. My academic work is in theology, and most of my published work is in poetry or poetic prose. Mm.
And you say the north of Ireland, that's a lot different than saying Northern Ireland. Could you elaborate on that a little bit?
Yeah, well, I tend to intersperse them. Deliberately. Ireland was partitioned in 1921 as the British were preparing to leave. They didn't leave the whole of the island of Ireland. They stayed in the northern six counties. And this new state was called Northern Ireland and was retained as part of the United Kingdom. Some people welcomed that move. Some people were distressed by that move. A civil war broke out in Ireland. And so there is a deep sense of disagreement as to what you call this place. So there isn't even an agreed upon name for a territory. Is it a country? Is it an occupied territory? Is it a region? Is it a province? How do you describe it? So two of the most widely used names are Northern Ireland or the North or the North of Ireland. So for me, I'm always interested in moving back and forth between both.
Yeah, and I've heard you speak on other podcasts as I was trying to dig up anything that you've been on, and talking about how there's a lot of different conflicts with the people of that region, including territory, but also sectarian issues between Protestants and Catholics, of course, and the ongoing troubles of the 30 years of conflict. And I mean, the United States, and definitely we've heard about violence, and we heard about the peace accord and things like that. But, and especially for younger people, I'd say people under maybe 30 years old or so, or 25 years old, I don't think that they grasp, especially in the United States or maybe other countries around the world, some of the carnage and some of the turmoil that actually happened in Ireland. And what was that like as you grew up? You were not in Northern Ireland, but as you move into these spaces where there's people who are still suffering the consequences of all that pain, and working with them to build bridges and work on forgiveness, and you know, those scars I'm sure run generations deep. What can you say about that in a context that people can understand from the outside?
Yeah, so I mean, partly I'd say that one of the ways to look at this is that the 20th century had a whole variety of border making initiatives around the world, where borders between countries were drawn or redrawn or eradicated or introduced, the carving up and the creating of a new country. And Ireland was one of those places. Now, it wasn't unique to the 20th century. It had been done previously as well. But one of the things we recognize is that when you try to draw a border, that borderlands and who is in and who is out, those dynamics can become very difficult. So, I mean, Britain had gone all over the world. At the start of, in the 1900s, I think Britain counted 400 million people in its empire outside of the island of Britain. So the empire of the British Empire had 400 million people. By 1965, I think it was, that empire, in terms of British subjects, as they might have been called, I think that was down to fewer than 5 million. And that was including Hong Kong at that stage, which, as you know, then at the end of that century returned to being Chinese territory. So that's an enormous decline. Now, I consider colonization to be an old word for what these days we would consider war. It was unfortunately the way of Christian extremism for 400 years, because religion was hand in glove with European colonization globally, where people would arrive with what they understood to be correct governance, with what they understood, with what was power in terms of dominance, but also what they understood to be morality and virtue, which was predominantly Christian. So the colonizing effects of Ireland had been ongoing for a number of hundred years, back and forth. Different territories of Ireland had been kind of under British rule at various points. Ireland wasn't one complete kingdom. So just because, for instance, the British were in Dublin, that didn't mean that the rest of the country was like, "Oh, right, we're British now." They were like, "It's just Dublin. We don't like them anyway." But then when colonizing forces remove themselves, the question is do they remove themselves entirely? Are there parts left where there are peoples who would wish to remain under that power? Ireland had been subject to a process called the plantation, where British subjects were given land and large swathes of land in the north of Ireland, which is why there was a lot of British people, and British people were predominantly Protestant, hence the Catholic Protestant thing here, which is much more about a political and ethnic and originally a linguistic divide than it was anything theological, for instance. People weren't fighting with each other about whether you did or didn't believe a particular doctrine about Mary. They were fighting with each other about how you understood who is it that has a right to be here and what language should we speak and who should be in governance. Is this Britain? Is this Ireland? So there was 30 years. So Northern Ireland was created. And at that stage, it was called a Protestant state for a Protestant people. And as 50 years went by of the first 50 years of Northern Ireland, it was convenient for some and inconvenient for others. Growing tensions were arising. And in 1968 to 1998, sectarian war broke out, where in that period, 3,600 people were murdered. And that's out of a population of 1.5 million. So I think I'm going to get the numbers wrong now, but I think it was something like 80,000 people were directly injured, and 500,000 people, which is about one in three, were affected either by injury, trauma, or bereavement, which is an enormous amount when you consider the population size. Mm. And in 1998, there was an internationally brokered UN peace agreement that saw the cessation of sectarian violence and initiated power sharing systems between people of differing opinions. And various protections were put in and various compromises were made, both by the British and the Irish governments, in order to secure a lasting peace for Northern Ireland.
And has that lasting peace worked in terms of violence?
Oh, yes. So, peace, I think sometimes people who haven't lived in a zone that's been conflicted think, well, when peace happens, peace has happened. Mm-hmm. Peace is a process. Mm-hmm. And zones of conflict understand that a process of peace usually will need to go on perhaps for as long as the process of violence had occurred. Mm. And depending as to who you talk to here, they might say anywhere from 40 to 70 to 700 years in terms of the discordant relationship between Britain and Ireland in terms of how it is that we live in our various islands with a sense of independence, as well as hopefully some kind of collaboration and collegiality with each other. So some enormous compromises and acceptances were made. Our policing system was entirely reformed because it was in serious need of being so. And structural provisions were given, various Dublin, London, Belfast governmental structures were put into place. And then there were recommendations that weren't followed through on so specifically, particularly in education. Mm. About 7% of young people go to schools that are formally integrated here. And integration will have a quota system based on the demographics of the area. So 50-50 isn't, Catholic Protestant isn't realistic in places where you might have 90% Catholics living, for instance. But they'll find a quota system that's appropriate. The other 93% of young people go to schools that I think you need to understand integration in an Irish context and not with the context that brings to a United States understanding. Mm-hmm. In the Irish context, the 93% of young people who go to schools that aren't part of the formal integrated sector, those schools might have plenty of processes of shared education, of ways in which teachers or pupils from one school or another take classes at the schools of the other, or they might do shared projects or maybe even have shared campuses. But particularly because of Catholic education, where you find sacramental education happens within the context of school, there are more reasons than just sectarian for people not to want to go to a formally integrated school. But nonetheless, the concern is that too many young people are getting to the stage of finishing their secondary education without really having a friend who comes from what might be called the other side of the community.
Oh, wow. Well, I know this for myself, but I know a lot of listeners might not know how Corrymeela community came into being. Could you back us up? Because it's the longest, is it the oldest peace community in the world?
Oh, in Ireland. I'm not sure about the world.
Okay. I got really grandiose for a second there.
Yeah, yeah. I'm quickly going to change our Twitter profile. So Corrymeela was founded by a Presbyterian minister, a man called Ray Davey. He was born in 1915. And he was a Presbyterian chaplain. He became a volunteer padre in the Second World War, a padre with the YMCA, and was captured and then moved around various prisoner of war camps, ending up in a prisoner of war camp just outside Dresden. And he saw the destruction of Dresden. And he recognized that, that brought about his liberation from a prisoner of war camp. But he recognized that if liberation can only come at the expense of the annihilation of others, well, then Ireland was going to rip itself apart because he was born before the island was partitioned, although he was partitioned by the time he was six or seven. But the sectarian divisions that were happening were already significant. So he came back from the war and began to work, which he did for the rest of his life as chaplain in Queen's University, or not the rest of his life, for many years. And he kept on looking to various new emerging communities that were springing up all across Europe for some support in terms of how it is that people from different parts of the sectarian divide here could meet with each other in friendship and faith and argument as well. And consensus was not the outcome. The aim was to find a way wherein people who did not have consensus on political matters nonetheless could live in a way that we weren't killing each other. And in 1965, when he was 50, a plot of land became available on the very north coast of Ireland, 6 acres. And there was an old house in it, a house owned by the Evangelical Holiday Fellowship. And it was a big ramshackle house that was mostly livable with a bit of work and tender care. So he raised the money in about 3 weeks and together with a lot of students started off what became known then as the Corrymeela community. And the word Corrymeela just comes from the name of the few fields where the property is. Every few fields in Ireland has a name. It's called a townland. It's got nothing to do with a town. And the townland for that area is called Corrymeela. And that's in Old Irish. I mean, I speak Modern Irish, but Old Irish is a fairly, it's oblique as to what much of the etymology means of place names particularly. And somebody initially said to him, oh, it means Hill of Harmony. And he thought, God, isn't that lovely to have a hill, a peace and reconciliation community on the Hill of Harmony. And it's only 14 miles across the water to Scotland. It's a really beautiful part of the world. Anyway, about 10 years later, by which stage the troubles had broken out. Hundreds of people had already been murdered. People had been displaced from their homes. Corrymeela was being used as a site for people who'd been given an hour to get out of their homes before they were said, you know, get out of your homes or you'll be dead in an hour or the house will be burnt down, whether you're in it or not. So in around 1975, somebody came through and said, oh, no, Corrymeela doesn't mean Hill of Harmony. It means something much more like lumpy crossing place. And they thought that's much more appropriate because we're not entirely sure how harmonious we are, but we're definitely a place of lumpy crossing. And that has become a word for us in the Corrymeela community, actually, to when we are at discord with ourselves, when we're trying to make decisions, or when we're recognizing the kind of successes that are true successes in peace are ways wherein you can have a serious disagreement with each other. And that can feel very painful, but you can do so without the threat of violence or exclusion being in the room.
Yeah, it's more true to life that it's bumpy.
Totally.
Yeah.
So we do love our lumpy crossing place.
And I love in The Shelter, your book, In the Shelter, Finding a Home in the World. There is a lot there that's, just for people who haven't, who aren't familiar with it, there's poetry, there's memoir, and there's a lot of storytelling in there, real stories with, I'm sure the names are changed and things to protect people. And you say people are sometimes more like verbs than nouns, and they're, in storytelling, people live, and sometimes their shadows are long sometimes, and storytelling makes up a big part of what happens at Corrymeela, and maybe and I believe that you have also a book coming out that incorporates some of what you do there. Maybe you could talk a little bit about that and some of how things work and how you interact with people and what are some of the things that you do.
Sure. So I suppose the primary question I'm hearing here is about story. And I have a dictionary of etymology, which I'm looking at right now as we talk. And the first thing I looked at when I got this dictionary of etymology was I looked up the understanding of that word story. What are some of the threads and fabric in that old word? And mixed among the many ways in which etymologists would explain the origin and the usage of the word story is a word for seeing and a word for wisdom. So I always like to think of story as the process of seeing wisely, in which case a story is never finished because we can always see wisely in new ways. And old stories are usually, they stay in the common imagination because there are so many different ways within which to see that old story. A story that says at the end, and this is how you interpret it, I don't think that that story will have too long a life. I'm much more interested in a story that has open-ended parts. Terence Tilley, in his book Story Theology, says the author of a story cannot control a story's power to reveal, which is an extraordinarily threatening thing if you're part of a system where you do want to control people's interpretations. And so situations of conflict inevitably bring about people telling stories, because in a situation where there's a conflict, people will want to go, how did that begin? You asked me just that. You asked me that just a while ago, Lisa. And so how did it begin? And I'll tell a story. Somebody might hear that and go, you began in the wrong place. You began too early. You began too late. Claire Mitchell, who's a Belfast-based sociologist, in one of her books, she said that Northern Ireland is a meta-conflict because there's conflict about what the conflict's about. And therefore, when it comes to understanding how we tell a story of a conflict, we need to recognize that stories must be plural with multiple starting points and with weight and allowing for the possibility, difficult though that is, of multiple interpretations of who the aggressor and who the benefactor is in a story, of understanding subtlety and of having a sophisticated understanding about blame. Because it's we don't live in a fairy story where we've got a baddie and a goodie, and the baddie is terribly, terribly bad and the goodie is absolutely lovely. That's not the situation. War brings out the worst in many people, and then war brings about collaborators, and war brings about awful things in situations. And somehow, if you have to wipe up the pieces afterwards and come to some kind of agreement about living with each other in a way where you're not killing each other, therefore, you need to find all kind of compromises, which perhaps in an ideological world you would much rather not make. But we don't live in that world. We live in a world where people have died. And in order to prevent other people from dying, we need to be in partnership with people, perhaps whom we would much rather not be. And they also, we each are probably the undesired collaborative partner with somebody else. We might look down at them and they also might look down at us for all kinds of reasons. And so Carmela from the word go has been about bringing people from different points of view of politics, religion, nationality together for the possibility of discovering that relationship and hospitality are possible even in situations of deep discord. So we work with around 10,000 people a year. At our centre on the north coast, we have 100 beds. So it's a residential centre, although not all the groups that come to us stay with us residentially. We also have work that travels out to different parts of Northern Ireland to all across the island of Ireland, work that will travel into Britain, and then from time to time also work that goes further afield. We certainly have many international collaborations with university groups from the United States, for instance, that come to Corrimela, or workplaces that seek some of our learning to share with some of their learning so that we can co-create ways of applying what we've been learning and the mistakes that we've been making over 50 years towards each other.
And then the book that you've, when does your new book come out that
talks that about? Comes out this summer. August with Canterbury Press. So Carmel is a Christian community. I mean, we're a broad Christian community with a wide table. We don't kind of put any doctrinal requirements on any staff. I mean, we have staff that come from various religious traditions and none. We have volunteers also that come from various religious traditions and none. And then we have this thing called the Carmela community, which is people in their ordinary life, teachers, doctors, people looking for work, people out of work, retired people, shop workers. We have the Carmela community, people who make a commitment once a year to be an active member of the community, incorporating reconciliation in their life, supporting the work financially, supporting the work with their time and volunteer time also. So for the Carmela community, we have a book of prayer that we go through each month. And the book of prayer has 31 texts from the Gospels. Most of those texts following the life of Jesus from birth to death and resurrection, but then also following the theme of do not fear throughout the Gospels. And so a publishing company approached me because I write collects, which is a particular form of prayer you find in Anglican and Catholic liturgy. And a publishing company approached and asked, would I write a book of collects? So I said, I'd like to write a book of collects that follow the 31 texts of the Gospels through the Carmela monthly cycle. So that's what is coming out this summer. But then there's an essay on prayer as well. And then there are, they say that books sell well in classifications of 40. And so I added in another 9 entries too. So there's morning and evening prayer. There's some collects for the Stations of the Cross. There's some prayers for time of change. There's some prayers for changing names. I like the idea that prayer can be applicable in places where you wouldn't have thought it would be applicable. So one of the prayers for a time of change is a prayer that I thought could be read, although it's not written specifically for this, but it's written, I hope, sensitively towards that. It's a prayer written where if people are trying to put language of prayer around a divorce, that they would be able to do so and turn to a prayer that give sacred linguistic attention to that kind of experience, because one of the learnings of Corrymeela is that, like, nobody prepares for being in war unless you're already in war, and it's taught you that you need to prepare. But similarly, nobody prepares for endings of things that you wouldn't have ever imagined would have ended. Mm. And how is it nonetheless that we can be brave in the usage of language? I don't mean fanciful. I do mean brave, using simple words during times where we are divided from each other.
Would you be able to read anything about that? I don't want you to read from your book if you're not allowed.
No, the publisher. I don't think the publisher would be publishers would be thrilled.
is there anything else that you can read that you've done that's similar in intent in poetry that is in the same vein?
Let me see. There's a poem that I tried to write. Well, I did write it. called Morning Prayer, which was trying to think about abortion. And so it's in three parts, but I'll read the third. So this is called Morning Prayer, and here's the third part. Jesus Christ, sweet Jesus Christ, dying Son of the living God, have mercy on me because you need to. Son of God, who never had a womb, here's my prayer, offered with empty hands and screaming. Here's my prayer of opinions and of meaning. Here's my prayer, my reasons, my heart dreaming. So I'm always interested in what kind of language do we need to use when we are in situations that are most divided. For instance, there was another time when we had people from various parts of the Irish divide in the same room with each other for 2 days, people of kind of British and Irish identities, people who'd taken up arms in all kinds of groups, people who'd been bereaved, people who had shot people, people who had had shots fired at them. We also had Israelis and Palestinians in the same room, mm-hmm. coming from all kinds of perspectives of politics and of peace and understanding also. Mm-hmm. And a discussion broke out amongst people about what the correct verb is to use when people have been, when somebody's died. So one person said that they use the word murder. They say, I murdered someone. Mm. And somebody else said, oh, I don't use that word because I was in a war and I was under orders and I was following through orders. So I wasn't murdering, I was following orders, even though people died. And somebody else said, oh, no, I took a life. That's the phrase that they used. And then somebody else said, well, it's different if they're a legitimate target or not a legitimate target. And so I was there as poet in residence for this group. And I was struck by how real the question of word choice is in situations like that. Like, this isn't fanciful, disembodied talk about linguistics. This is the stuff where words really matter. So this is, again, actually this poem is also in three parts, and I'll read the third part. It's called The Pedagogy of Conflict. When I was a child, I learned to count to five. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. But these days I've been counting lives, so I count one life, one life, one life, one life, one life. Because each time is the first time that life has been taken. Legitimate target has 16 letters and one long, abominable space between two dehumanizing words.
It's remarkable how you enter into these things with your whole heart, and I know that a lot of it has to do with your own pain that you've experienced in your life and your own encounters and probably current encounters with exile and being able to be moved deeply and encountering your own sorrow. And I've heard you say that the word exile in, and I'm not sure which language it is, but has to do with the word for tears.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, in Irish, Joriocht. Yes. It means to be in a state of tearfulness. Mm.
And maybe you can talk a little bit about what exile has meant for you a little bit in your life. And in the book, I mention it because in your book, In the Shelter, you talk quite a bit about exile, and it's a theme. And then the book is really about welcoming and saying hello to different things, whether it's the painful things or the joyful things or the terrifying things.
I think, I mean, both on a literary as well as a literal level, exile interests me. It's an extraordinary theme in biblical literature. I think the writings around the Babylonic exile are amongst the most exquisite and beautiful in Hebrew Bible. Certainly the writings of the prophet Jeremiah I find amazing, and the second part of Isaiah. I mean, they are extraordinary. And then you think of the kind of wildness of the prophet Ezekiel also. Mm. Those kind of intensities gathered around that. Obviously, there were other periods of history with similar intensities. But there's something about the poetry that was evoked in exile in Hebrew literature that really fascinated me when I was doing theological study. And as well, within that, how the place of exile is the place when you need to do an enormous amount of reevaluation. Usually in exile, we fantasize about going back to the way things were. That rarely seems to be the way that things work out. So in exile, for instance, there was this question about how can God hear us? Because in order to pray to God, it was understood perhaps that you needed to be in the promised land. And so hence you get that beautiful psalm, by the rivers of Babylon, we hung up our harps and wept, for how can the Lord hear us in a foreign land? And that was a literal question. That wasn't just kind of poetic lamenting. It was a literal question. How can God hear us here? Because we're not in God's country. God's country is back over there. And so usually your theology needs to undergo a change. Your understanding about who you are needs to undergo a change. And then if you ever do return, actually, because you have changed, you'll bring back your change with you. So exile forces, wanted or unwanted, enormous changes in the way that we understand what it means to be us and to be us in community, whatever that community might be, desired or undesired. I think within that there is the recognition that exile forces change. Violent change, national change, religious change, all kinds of change, change of belonging, change of family, change of allies also, because it may be that in exile you find yourself being allied to people with whom you would not have otherwise been allied to previous to that. Mm. So for me in my own life, I mean, growing up gay, and while now that doesn't seem like too dramatic a thing, certainly in rural Ireland in the 70s and 80s, growing up gay very definitely meant that you had to learn how to lie very quickly if you were to avoid being beaten up. And mm-hmm. I thought I was a good liar, but I still didn't avoid some of those things. Mm. And then interested in religion as I was, and I always was, and from the age of 18 I started to work in full time in Christian ministry, I suppose you'd call it, lay Christian ministry. I learned how to keep secrets there and went through, I was in a charismatic context, so I went through 3 public exorcisms and a year of what was called reparative therapy to try to change sexual orientation. And all of these violences that I became a collaborator in, because I was desperate to fit into the system too. Mm. And so much like colonization, you know, I was divided and conquered as well by myself. I didn't need a devil. I had myself, and I was often worse than that. And so I was desperately searching for the causation of why I was gay and the cure, the potential cure, trying to figure out how all of these things could be exorcised from me or therapied from me. And to engage in that work so intensely causes a desperate level within yourself. And at that stage, I didn't have much confidence in my understanding of theology, and certainly anybody who presented themselves as an expert, either in matters of religion or psychology, I trusted them. Naively, I trusted them. There was a period when I'd been in this reparative therapy for about a year, and I screwed up the courage to say to the therapist, I don't even like calling him that, you know, the man who's calling himself therapist, I mustered up the courage to say to him, I don't even want to have sex with a woman, because it was all so sexually fixated. You know, that cure would be demonstrated by the fact that you might find a woman attractive or something. So the conversations were like that, which is extraordinarily predatory on the bodies of women. And I think that's that highlights one of the projects involved in these reparative interventions that you see, is that the many of them that I've come across are usually built upon some kind of power relationship with the body female.
A conquest,
yeah. So I said this to him, I don't even know if I want to have sex with a woman. And he said to me, that's because you're saying the sentence wrong. He said, you shouldn't want to have sex with a woman, you should want to give sex to a woman. And I remember thinking, what? And because I had no confidence in psychology or theology. At that stage, I had four languages, Irish, English, bad French, and bad sign language. But I love language. And I remember thinking, like, I am not a man of learning. But that's bullshit.
He crossed the line. That's it.
He crossed the line by conjugating a sentence poorly. And so I got up and left. And they said that was the exorcism.
Yes. Yeah.
That was the exorcism. Because suddenly I believed something.
Oh.
And I got on the bus, the number 16 bus, went from the south side to the north side of Dublin, where I was living at that stage. And I could tell nobody, because nobody else would celebrate with me. You know that line that you find in Luke's Gospel, in the chapter of the stories of the lost coin, the lost sheep, the lost son.
Yeah.
And when the woman finds the lost coin, it's a beautiful thing. She calls her friends and celebrates with them. So maybe she spent more than the coin, which I think is a lovely, delicious piece of detail in that story. But she calls them and says, celebrate with me, because this is fun. I had nobody with whom I could celebrate. So I celebrated by myself.
Yeah,
but that was good enough.
Well, like he sort of in one fell swoop revealed his foolishness was revealed to you in a really powerful way, where you realize this is the end of the road, of this road that I'm trying to go down. This is a dead end.
Yeah. And it all fell apart.
Yeah.
And I never went back.
Well, you know, but you went down to the grave with your own loneliness. You were talking about in the book the word for loneliness and grave in Irish is like the root word is similar. And I thought that was, it's so profound, because in a way it's sort of interesting that you can be in a sense prepared for your own death by encountering loneliness head on, in a sense of becoming acquainted with it, but not hopefully to despair, but then also in a sense that you that it's such a bitter thing to experience.
It is, but we all have to face our own loneliness. I mean, loneliness is just another way of speaking about inadequacy or the end of ourselves. And those things should not be frightening. I mean, of course we're inadequate. Of course we are ignorant about many things. Not finally, but the idea that we can be all sufficient for all times is an illusion. And so uignach is the word in Irish for lonely. And uig, the first part of that, is the word for grave. And so I like to think that loneliness is a foretaste for recognizing death, and recognizing that death is a part of every life. And I think we have a wise companion in loneliness. I don't mean pathological loneliness. I'm not trying to romanticize loneliness that is severely isolating. But I mean the kind of ordinary loneliness that even a life that has moved beyond isolation nonetheless has to come to terms with.
In the sense of that, in a sense that we can never be sort of wholly known by another person, loneliness in that way?
You can never be wholly known by ourself.
Right. Right. Yes.
Who are we? And why do we do the things we do? And how is it that we understand who we are? And what do we do when we have nothing to occupy us? And why do we not do some things that we know would be good for us? And what is it that causes us to make certain deep decisions? Like, who are we? Why do we turn to poetry? Why did I, from the youngest age, turn to poetry? Like, how did that happen? I can point to the fact that the Irish education system had me and all of us at the age of five learning poems off in two languages. So that certainly imbibes a culture with poetry. But would that have happened anyway? Who are we? Are we just ourself? And is ourself just one, or is ourself many? These are questions for the individual. And I think within the context of that, if you can recognize that we are a mystery to ourself, well, then therefore you're likely to be more compassionate with the mystery of another person. Because if I have a disordered relationship with my own loneliness, well, then presumably I'm going to demand far too much of other people in order to quell my own.
Such a beautiful paradox, too, because in encountering your loneliness in something like poetry and walking right through it, then someone else sees that and says, me too.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, it is fascinating. I mean, I wrote poetry from the age of 11. I mean, some of it I wrote in code because I was mortified that anybody would read it and know what I was writing about. And years later, I mean, it might have been 10 years later, I showed a friend a poem, and she said, how long have you been writing? I'm like, oh, 10 years. And she said, you need to do something with these. And it was the first time in my life that I thought that this was any other way than just survival. And I'd read a lot of poetry, but it had never occurred to me that poetry for me was about publishing. Poetry for me was always the art of survival. And that helped me and continues to help me. And so I write because I need to. If I have some success in publishing, that is a joy and something I don't take lightly, something I work hard about, but that is not the purpose. The purpose is to survive. And that is why I turn to it.
I'm curious as to whether you ever do journaling as a spiritual practice or something that you do. And do you think of those things as, I mean, I'm sure you think of them as distinctly different, but do you feel like you have the energy to do something like journaling as well?
Yeah, I've done journaling for years. Not as intensely now. I tend to write more poetry now, so poetry tends to take that over. But I ultimately, what journaling or poetry or anything is it's trying to put language and language in form around experience, to find a way to narrate our lives back to ourselves in a way where it's bigger than the story we're narrating. And I think that all of those things engage in form in one way or another, some formal, some not so formal, but nonetheless they do engage in form. And I mean, I think any discipline like that begins to have the quality of liturgy for us, the work of liturgy meaning the work of the people, and it speaks itself back to us, and we find some kind of an echo and we begin to pay attention to a life. And I think to pay attention is a wise thing, because there are such deep rivers in us that move us sometimes for all kinds of reasons and with all kinds of outcomes, and it's worthwhile being somewhat familiar with those deep currents in us. For a long time too, I remember during a very, very difficult period of time, I was reading Augustine's Confessions, which is an extraordinary piece of writing. I mean, Augustine at one point was going to the theater too many times a day or a week, I don't know how many times. Augustine thinks everything is a sin as he narrates his life to God. So anyway, this is just the latest. He thought he was sinning because as a child he cried when he probably wasn't hungry, so therefore anyway. But he actually sounds like somebody who's Netflix binging. That's the extraordinary thing, is when you look at he's going, why was I even there? Did I care about this theater? Was it helping me in any way? Like, what was I doing there that was helping me not to pay attention to stuff that I should have been doing elsewhere? And actually, I think that's a really wise piece of passage about an era when we can allow ourselves to be distracted by distraction, almost like a consistent habit. So I was reading through Augustine's Confessions. I'd read it through once already, and I decided to read through again. And his chapters are very short, sometimes a paragraph, sometimes maybe a page. And so I'd read three or four chapters and just write out the couple of sentences from those chapters that I'd like. And then I wrote a letter back to Augustine. And it was amazing. And I continued to treasure the discipline of those months, because an hour would pass by in something called prayer, in something called writing, in something called the inner life. I don't know what it needs to be called. I don't know if it needs to be called anything, mm-hmm. but it was a practice, mm-hmm. and it made that hour so safe during a period of time of extraordinary difficulty, mm-hmm. when actually prayer could have been a burden and not mm-hmm. a blessing. And it really did turn into something that I turned to for comfort. I'd get up early to do it if I knew I had a busy day. Or I'd squeeze in something late at night to figure out how I could turn in that hour to that. And that is, again, the art of words in the place of need.
That's extraordinary. And it goes to show that it's a kind of prayer form that, you know, prayer doesn't have to look any certain way. It just has to help us really just to sort of wake up, come into ourselves more fully, and to
watch.
Yeah.
Yeah. To watch your own life, the lives around you, to watch what's happening. Yeah.
I'm wondering if you can speak to us being people of conversation and peace, and being able to inhabit space with each other better, and how we might be able to this is true in places where you can hide in anonymity online and things like that, but even in spaces where we don't try to meet each other or really look into each other's eyes very much anymore, do you have any words of wisdom on how we can create times and places and spaces for really interacting and coming to a place where we are with people we really don't agree with, and in ways that don't continue to hurt and destroy each other?
Well, there's a poem coming to mind, actually, Lisa, that I'd like to read to you. This one isn't published. I wrote it last year in Australia, when I was poet in residence with the with the Uniting Church in Victoria and Tasmania. Although I suppose the first thing that came to mind, and this is why the poem came to mind, and I know you may have meant this, but in terms of recognizing death, the awful thing is that people have been dying all the time for the project called America. People who were there before the project called America started, and then people who were displaced and treated as and turned into slaves. And one of the things that I think is really important is for most societies to recognize the ways in which we can turn to the story of our pasts and recognize that we have been complicit in the fractures that have undone us. Maybe we have had the luxury of thinking that that doesn't really happen. That's just luxury. That isn't truth. And it usually finds a way to remind us of itself at some point. And then there's a whole population of other people who will go, you mean that's news to you? You haven't thought about that. I remember when I was probably an overly intense, but nonetheless, I had to be truthful to myself, 25-year-old, talking to a friend of mine's mum, who was at that stage in her mid-50s, and I mean, I suppose I thought she was ancient, and such as is the way of 25-year-olds. And she said recently, oh, I've been trying to develop a way within which my Christianity can have an understanding of suffering. She goes, it's new for me. And I looked at her, this is over a lunch, and I said, how have you gotten to your age without that? And I think she was looking at me to say, how can you be that age and not know the opposite? But it seemed to me like, how have you gotten to the stage like that when you haven't had to reckon with suffering? And I think one of the things in the United States, and I've never lived there, I've visited there plenty, but one of the things that I see that's going on is this idea of the pure, that in the that there can be this kind of reaction that seems to imply that any critique against anything established is implying that it is entirely corrupt, and the response to that is to try to prove its entire purity. And that is a waste of time, because nothing is pure, except perhaps suffering. And I don't mean that in a holy sense. So therefore, how is it that we can find the language where, when we are speaking with each other, we can recognize impact and recognize the levels of impact? Because the shame that somebody might feel to pay attention to their luxury is not the shame that somebody feels when their life is threatened. To acknowledge that does not undo both of those experiences of shame, but it does give us a roadmap for where we should begin with our attention and where we should begin with our revolution in terms of changing things. That's what I mean by revolution, the turning of something, to revolve something. If we need to change something in order to be better, we do need to find a language to pay attention to where is the suffering most acute. And if we do need to triage each other, and if our society needs triaging, we need to look to where death is happening. And that requires very, very painful societal questions, and also an extraordinarily painful reckoning with our past. Because Emily Dickinson said, the past is such a curious creature. And it is. And you need to look at it in a way where it won't kill you, but also where you don't make it up. It's called A Question About the Story of Us. And it was written in Australia. And within 15 years of the establishment of the city of Melbourne, 85% of the indigenous population of what is now called the state of Victoria was dead. And so this poem doesn't come in the right order, deliberately. A Question About the Story of Us, Part 2. This is a question about stories that are told about other older stories, about old blood and older stones. Some history is written in the town halls of Europe, Melbourne, Mildura, like measles, imports to be endured. In some countries, if you add 15 years to 85%, you have a paragraph on a page of history. Here, there is lament, and we'd even hear the stone's own keening if we'd learn to learn their meaning. Part 3. Is this a question of being the right color or of asking the wrong question? Is this a story about them or a question about the story of us? Part 4. Yesterday, I met a child who had one time almost died. And during her poorly nights, I had sung the songs my mother sang to me and to her little frightened ears. Then she had not been 2 years old, but yesterday she told me a story about my old mother's song, and I'm thinking that melody is longer than memory. Part 1. And one time I asked a man, "How old are you?" And he said, "Older than that question, son." Part 5. So come, carve out a hollow place of shame. Search and find the name to name this place. It is not even ours to give. We must just discover. Part 3. Again. This is not a story about them. This is a story about the questions, about the stories that we tell, and how well we tell them. The part in that about the song, there was a woman I met there who had been a chaplain in a children's hospital. And it's true, there was a two-year-old. I'm not even sure she was as old as two, that was recovering from very serious illness, was in hospital. And I mean, medics know, and anybody working in a hospital know that touch is part of health. You know that a child that hasn't been held enough will suffer in physical ways as well as other ways. So this chaplain, who used to feel so helpless, used to, with this particular child, and my guess is with many others, hold them late at night when staff might have had other things to do, and she'd sing to them. And anyway, there was this one particular child whose parents she ended up getting to know, and she used to sing a particular song that her mother taught her. And then about 8 years later, she met the parents of that child, and the child was there, and the child began to hum this song to her. And at this stage, her mother had died. And she thought, how do you know this? And I think suddenly she realized that the song was singing them rather than she singing the song.
Wow. That's amazing. And that kind of, her love was really, it's just amazing. It's kind of like the carrier of love in a way, woven into the song and woven into her healing. And you know, you there's a remarkable part of your book where you talk about counting hugs. And you know, in talking about loneliness and touch and feeling isolated and alone and in exile, and then talking about contact and finding friendship and connection again, or coming into that, did you feel that you were trying to find your way into friendships and like socially anxious and things like that, and then when you finally had a chance to hug people, you were going to like take every hug you could get?
I mean, I think isolation, and I think it's fair enough to say that like, were I a professional adult intervening in my own life, I would intervene on a significant level. Like, there were many things that deserved very serious interventions. And I think, of course, like, at the age of 11, I was hugged for the first time. And I remember thinking, this is what arms are for. Because it was, I had never before considered the quality of the arm. And I suddenly did. And of course then, I mean, by the time I was 18, I was able to count up to 60. And I knew every single name of every single person and everything where it had happened. And I used to repeat it to myself at nights when I couldn't sleep, like a litany. And within that, of course, there is this idea that if you could just spend your life in the opposite of isolation, that therefore the question about the human condition will be solved. But nothing is good enough. And that isn't cynicism. I think that's poetry. There's always going to be the space. Paul Valery has this line where he says, God made everything out of nothing, but then nothing still follows us. I have the quote slightly wrong, but it's something like that. And I think that's one of the questions that we will have to face, whether on an individual life, how to live our life well, or on the level of a society like ours here that's trying to remove itself from violent conflict. There's still going to be conflict. The question is what's the quality of the conflict? There's still going to be discord. There's still going to be people who think, I do not like that politician and I would rather be elected than they, or whatever. Like, those are signs of life, not signs of despair. But they all need that little bit of hollowness at the heart in order to give that spark of the chaos that's needed for the art of being alive and the art of argument.
Yes, I was thinking of a really similar thing about desire and wanting to fill desire and loneliness and the empty space that comes from that great empty space of loneliness and feeling unloved, and then thinking that desire can also propel us to the other and to project us outward into seeing outside ourselves and to seeing that need is everywhere.
Yes, it does. I mean, but if we think that, I mean, Augustine, to go back to him, says, I'm going to get some of the words wrong, but he says, late, oh late, have I loved you, beauty ever ancient and ever new. You were within me, but I was in the world outside myself. And the way that Augustine speaks about the heart is always the place where God was and always the place that we're supposed to return to, and that Augustine spread himself abroad so widely through learning, through, I mean, it's all good things, through learning, through entertainment, and through sex. He just kept on trying to spread himself abroad when he, toward the end of his life, began to recognize that the journey was always back to the heart and God was always there. He didn't need to journey to God. God was always there. He just wasn't in himself enough. And so I think, especially if you feel lonely and you felt like you've been caged in yourself, the idea is might be that by the journey outward that you'll find answers. And that's partly true, of course. I mean, I was delighted to move away from isolation. I was delighted to get to the stage where I could walk into a group of people and have the expectation of kindness rather than the opposite. So that was thrilling. But that will never be the final satisfaction. You will still need to return to yourself.
Yes. Well, Padraig, where could people find out more about your work and find you on the internet or social media?
Yeah, on the internet, my own website, padraigotuma.com. I have links there to YouTube things and download podcasts. I'll put a link to this podcast up, Lisa, as well. There's information there about the books as well, where you can find them. Actually, I just had a piece published in a journal today that I put the link up. I've been doing a lot of speaking at nursing conferences in the last year about the value of language and story within the medical context. So I was asked to write for a journal, and I thought, God almighty, if I try to write anything academic, my severe incapacity, like I can make poems rhyme or I can make poems meaning, but like I couldn't save you if you were sick. So I, rather than try to fudge it, I said, can I write a poem? And they said I could. I was delighted. Never has writing a poem been such a relief. So anyway, there's a link to that up. That just went up today. On Twitter, I'm on Twitter as well. If you search my name, I think you'll find it. Corey Mila, we're online, corrymila.org, CORRYMEELA. And then on Twitter at Corey Mila, and on Facebook as well at Corey Mila.
Very good. Yeah, I will also have show notes in case the spelling is going to trip anybody up.
Sure, yeah. The books are available on Amazon. My understanding is that people need to be patient because the books are printed in primarily in England, actually, but there are some printed here. So it does just take a little while for the book ship to make its way to America. I'll be speaking at the Michigan Festival of Faith and Writing next Easter, which is in Michigan, obviously, yes. In Calvin College, is that right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yes. Wonderful.
And then I'll also be speaking at an event in February at 1440 Multiversity, which is in the country of California.
Yeah, maybe they will be their own country.
They already are.
Yeah.
It's like Texas. I'm from Cork, which often might consider itself to be the Irish equivalent of the country of Texas. And so, yeah, Cork people and Texas people are very proud of our sense of our own republics.
This has been so lovely. I'm just deeply honored and appreciative that you would share some time with me.
My pleasure. My pleasure. All the best, Lisa.
Hi, everybody. Don't head off just yet. Today's show notes for this episode are totally free. Just go over to patreon.com/sparkmymuse. Normally, show notes are reserved for sponsors that support the show at $1 a month, but not today. I felt that with all the special spelling and everything like that, I wanted to make it super easy for everybody to get information about Padraig and his work and all the people mentioned in the show. So I hope you'll head over to patreon.com/sparkmymuse. I'm very happy to take donations for the show, of course, and I would love to have you as a sponsor starting at $1 or more. There's lots of extra goodies to check out. So do that while you're there and see if you would like to support the show. I hope you really enjoyed it. I might have to listen to it a few more times myself. Come back next week for another episode and have a great day.